Why do car companies like to manufacture overseas, and what happens if they don't? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, who is on assignment. It is Tuesday, January 3rd. Good to have you with us. We are starting the show today with a story about jobs and manufacturing. President-elect Donald Trump called out General Motors over cars that the company makes in Mexico. Trump says GM should make the compact Chevy Cruze model in the U.S. General Motors and Ford have both come under fire from Trump for making cars overseas. In fact, Ford said today it would scrap plans for a Mexican factory and keep 700 jobs in the U.S. But these are international companies with a very real reason to want to build cars abroad. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Trump called out GM on Twitter for sending Mexican-made Chevy Cruzes to U.S. car dealers tax-free, threatening to slap a hefty border tax on the vehicles if the practice continues. In a statement, GM says only a fraction of the Mexican Cruzes were shipped to the U.S. and that most were in fact sold domestically in Mexico.
It's projected to be a larger domestic market than Canada.
Dave Andrea is with the Center for Automotive Research. He says many car makers are manufacturing abroad, not just to access cheap labor, but also to get their products into emerging markets.
These are all international corporations, and so they have to have a global manufacturing footprint to be close to their markets.
The trend toward making smaller cars in Mexico is an effort to lower labor costs while also using higher-paid U.S. workers to build more profitable trucks, SUVs, and luxury cars. Jeremy Acevedo is an analyst at Edmunds.com. He says it makes more sense to produce the higher-margin trucks in the U.S.
There certainly are trucks that are produced abroad and imported here, but by and large, you're seeing that the smaller vehicles, the ones that have smaller margins for automakers, are the ones that are into Canada and Mexico more frequently.
Also, in response to pressure from the president-elect, Ford today announced it's abandoning plans for a $1.6 billion plant in Mexico, instead investing $700 million in its Michigan operation. The company, however, will still make the majority of its small cars in Mexico. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Thinking about the auto industry brings us to another story about trade. Trump also announced today that he'll nominate Robert Lighthizer as U.S. trade representative. Lighthizer worked in the Reagan administration during the U.S. trade war with Japan when they levied some tough sanctions on that country. So how did those sanctions work, and what kind of effect would they have today against China? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
In the 1980s, Japan was the trading partner some politicians loved to hate, kind of like China is today. Clyde Prestowitz was a top official in the Commerce Department then. He helped hammer out tough trade deals with Japan in the early 80s.
When the Japanese auto industry began to eat up Detroit.
You know, when Toyotas and Hondas arrived, Prestowitz says Japan agreed to limits on its auto exports to the U.S., and Prestowitz helped negotiate an agreement that opened the Japanese market to U.S. computer chip companies like Intel. But that doesn't mean it'll be easy now as we deal with China. Prestowitz says there are more limits on the power of U.S. presidents in trade disputes, and products aren't made in just one country anymore. If the U.S. sanctions China, companies can move production elsewhere.
Mexico, it might be somewhere else in Asia.
Ulrika Shada is a professor of Japanese business at the University of California, San Diego.
There's lots of countries with lower cost of manufacturing.
And then there's this. Back when the U.S. restricted imports of those Hondas and Toyotas, the price went up. But people still bought them. Today, U.S. consumers have gotten used to buying cheap imports from China. Sheldon Richmond is with the Independent Institute, a free market think tank.
There's no law about how individuals will act if a tariff raises prices.
So if the U.S. hiked prices on Chinese imports, who knows? Maybe we'd keep buying them, even if they were a bit more expensive. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's been a busy day in Washington, the first day of the new GOP-controlled Congress, and the Senate just introduced a plan to repeal a big piece of the Affordable Care Act. With a simple majority, Republicans can undo budget-related elements like the Medicaid expansion and insurance subsidies. That's the easy part. What we don't know is what a replacement plan would look like and whether it would come along with a repeal or after. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on one of the options, insurance for catastrophic events like an accident or serious illness.
Republicans say they want to improve the quality of care and spend less for it. The question is how. The first step, says James Capretta with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, is accept one simple fact.
If someone gets a diagnosis of cancer, you're immediately into bills that, you know, almost anybody except the very, very affluent would have to have insurance for. And so everybody needs to be insured in case that happens.
In some Republican circles, there's a belief that health insurance exists not to cover the basics, like a checkup, but to protect people from financial ruin. So there's growing interest in providing all Americans from age 18 to 65 with financial help to cover the cost of catastrophic plans, plans that carry $5,000 to $7,000 deductibles, for example. That would cost the government less than it's currently spending to cover the cost of the Obamacare subsidies. But here's the trade-off.
Research is showing that a substantial number of Americans don't have the money to cover their deductible.
That's Mark Fendrick with the University of Michigan. It's pretty clear high deductibles make it hard for the poor and the sick. Fendrick is working closely with Republican leaders to design a new high deductible insurance that would include some valuable preventative services at little or no cost. And it forces consumers to spend their own money on care that at least arguably is more wasteful, like unnecessary tests. Harvard's Kate Baker says there's an opportunity here, but it's tricky.
Who should be deciding what's high-value care and what's low-value care?
It's questions like those, says Baker, that will keep Republicans up late at night as they dismantle Obamacare. The real challenge here is finding ways to improve our health system, a challenge that dates back more than 50 years. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, modest green. Details when we do the numbers. Last year, for the first time ever, more than a million foreign students were enrolled in U.S. schools. That can be great for colleges, which benefit from the full tuition that a lot of those students pay. But for the students themselves, making it in the U.S. once they graduate can be tough, and might be about to get tougher. From New York, Adrian Mall reports.
Inside the Student Center at Columbia University, hundreds of students in business attire are shuffling to and fro, shaking hands, and looking kind of nervous. They're here for the school's grad student career fair. And while job hunting can be nerve-wracking for anyone, the stakes are different for Columbia's nearly 13,000 international students.
I'm from Brazil.
I'm from India.
China.
Turkey.
Greece.
If they don't find jobs, they may have to leave the country. And even if they do get hired, many will need sponsorship for a work visa. Kaiju Chen is a 27-year-old engineering student from Taiwan, and so far, he's not having a lot of luck.
When I get the flyer of the company, some of the companies say that they do sponsor international students, but when I get in and ask them directly, some of them say, no, we don't actually sponsor it.
On top of visa worries, foreign students face obstacles that Americans don't, like language or cultural barriers. Many don't have family here, so the whole my uncle knows a guy networking strategy often doesn't apply. That was the case for Steve Chi, who's originally from South Korea.
I always thought as an international student, it's almost impossible to get a job here. But I always wanted to stay in U.S. and have some working experience here.
So last spring, before graduating Boston College, Chi started looking for work. When I asked him how many jobs he applied for, he said,
oh, God, I can't even remember. Countless.
Like 50?
Oof, no, not even that. I would write 30 apps per day.
People told him, go to job fairs and find yourself a mentor.
But, I mean, how do you do that in like an hour with like 50 people in a room?
Anxious and frustrated, Chi turned to an online career coaching startup called Paragon One. The International Coach Federation estimates there are thousands of career coaches in the U.S., but it doesn't have an estimate for how many market to foreign students. Chi says he went with Paragon because it offers that expertise.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
Hi, I'm doing very well.
That's Chi in a video chat with a former Bain consultant named Maeve Wang. Here, she's coaching him on interview strategy.
You got to make sure you ask clarifying questions. If you don't ask clarifying questions and you launch straight in, it dings you.
Yeah.
This sort of mentor-on-demand service isn't cheap, by the way. According to the company, the average client pays $2,000 to $4,000 bucks. Still, Steve Chi says after a couple of months of coaching, he managed to land a job with a consulting firm in New Jersey.
I first thought it was a miracle. If it wasn't for this, I probably would have gone back home.
Still, if Chi wants to work here for more than a year, he'll probably need sponsorship for a type of high-skilled worker visa called an H-1B. And those are increasingly hard to get. Since 2015, the U.S. has received close to 500,000 H-1B applications. Only a third of those have been granted. Jason Finkelman's a lawyer who specializes in work visas, and he says since the election, he's been getting dozens of calls a week from clients wondering if President-elect Donald Trump will make it harder to get an H-1B visa.
We don't know what he's going to do. And I get these calls from people and companies, and I just have to answer it and say, I don't know.
The Trump transition team didn't respond to our request for clarification. In the meantime, Steve Chi says he's happy at his job, and he's planning to apply for an H-1B visa next year, even if he's not sure whether he'll get it. In New York, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
You just heard that story from New York, which has a lot of schools. This next story is about a different kind of college town. We recently came across this headline in the Wall Street Journal. There's an antidote to America's long economic malaise, college towns. In the story, researchers looked at 16 places where overall job growth was strong, even though manufacturing growth fell more there than in the U.S. overall. Half of those places were also homes to colleges. We brought in Bob Davis from the Wall Street Journal, who wrote the story. Thanks for coming on.
Nice to be here.
Why don't you describe for me what Lee County in Alabama was like in, say, the late 1990s?
Well, Lee was going through the problems that a lot of communities were. It was businesses there were having a hard time keeping up with Chinese imports. A number of the businesses also were being automated out of existence, and the area was starting to be full of downtowns with empty offices and not much traffic.
And I would imagine most people listening have been in places that have that empty feeling. What would it look like if we drove through it today?
Well, now one of the areas, Auburn, is a college town, a sort of thriving college town. So it's turned around and it's doing quite well.
I ask those questions, obviously, because this is, you know, the thesis of this story that you wrote about areas that are booming. And it seems like it's because they have a university there. Tell me how you found this.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I've done a series of stories on trying to explain the Trump and Sanders phenomenon. One of the stories looked at places that were greatly impacted by Chinese imports. And the number one place, the most vulnerable place, was a town called Callaway County, Kentucky. And I called there thinking, you know, I'd find a place that just was down on its luck. But the unemployment rate was pretty good. And you looked around and you said, well, why is this? And what you found was the presence of a, you know, lesser-known university, Murray State, that had a good engineering and business department, and that made all the difference. But the idea that colleges made a difference economically kind of stuck with me.
You wrote this under the banner of an antidote to America's economic malaise. And I guess I wonder, what is this special spark that a college town can provide to industry?
Well, if you think about colleges as an employer, if you're in a small city and it's a, you know, reasonably sized school, it might be the biggest employer in town. But in addition, what a college does, if we think about it, is a college, their product is educated students. And particularly the way the economy is moving, where skills are rewarded and education is rewarded, the colleges, if they work with the local economic development officials, can be magnets for companies looking to relocate. And also, if you have professors in there that are working in the science or engineering field, you might have people who are, you know, entrepreneurs, basically, and want to stay in the area and like to stay in the area and build businesses as well.
Do you think this is a replicable model that could be used around the U.S.? After all, it seems like one of the positives in some of these places there's a fairly low cost of living.
It's not a foolproof system by any means. Just because you have a college doesn't mean you're going to be economically advantaged, but they become an anchor in a lot of places where there just isn't anything else.
Bob Davis from the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
AI has in recent years undergone a huge revival.
But can a computer spot fake news? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 119.6% to close at 19,881. The NASDAQ gained 45.8% to land at 5429. And the S&P 500 advanced 19.8%, finishing at 2257. First trading day of 2017. Strap yourself in. Could be a little bumpy. Lots of car news today. We discussed General Motors earlier. After our initial drop in share price, the company bounced back, ending up 0.8%. Meanwhile, Ford shares revved up 3.75% after Fiat Chrysler said yesterday it was working with Alphabet on connected car systems. Their share price went up 4.7%. Bonds stayed flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note was 2.44%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. If you wander around a grocery store, where things are can seem random. But it's far from that. Food and beverage manufacturers often have to pay money to get their products onto shelves, and that can be particularly hard for small manufacturers. And even if they make hot products like organics and naturals, it can be really tough for small companies to compete against the big guys. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at some of these challenges.
Welcome. Please scan your first item.
Andy Horo is stoked to see his company's new bottled tea in the refrigerated case in a Julasco. It's a grocery chain in Chicago. And that fridge is prime real estate. It's in a high-traffic area right near the checkout.
This is coveted space.
Horo is chief marketing officer of Wholesome Tea, a small company based in the Chicago suburbs. Its new bottled tea is called Inco's Organic Energy Tea. It's a healthy take on energy drinks, a white tea base with ingredients like ginseng.
People obviously want energy. They're continually looking for caffeine and other products to give them a boost throughout the day, but they're looking for something better.
Landing the product in the refrigerated case, where the chances of customers noticing it and buying it are much higher, it's kind of just luck. Horo and his partners bought the Inco's brand a couple years ago and gave it an organic reboot. Their company is young and doesn't have a distributor coming into Julasco constantly to make sure products get into that cold drink case or are well stocked over in the organic aisle. Instead, those tasks may fall to the retailer, which has tons of other products to stock.
I mean, most of the stores here, they do a great job, but sometimes when retailers restock the shelves, they put the new stuff in front and they don't always pull it forward.
So old inventory may pile up, which is clear today. Horo grabs a bottle off the shelf.
This is one of mine. This is a really old one. It actually expired quite a while ago. So
many of the competing products on the shelves do have the benefit of what's called direct store delivery, where delivery reps come in regularly to restock and rotate products. This is a really big deal because if your product isn't on the shelf, you lose sales. But those distribution services are expensive and out of reach for many small manufacturers. That's according to Gary Hemphill, director of research with the Beverage Marketing Corporation.
Those systems are closed off to a lot of startups because they're dominated by the big companies, by the Pepsis and the Cokes. So tricky to get in because those companies would prefer to be distributing their own products because it's more profitable for them that way.
A surprising number of Wholesome Tea's competitors have big conglomerates behind them. Honest Tea, owned by Coca-Cola. Sweetleaf, Nestle. Tazo, it's a Starbucks product. And if their deep-pocketed parent companies don't distribute them, those brands turn to independent distributors, which for startups might still be too expensive. Startups do have their advantages, though. Deanna Sheehan with Kantar Retail says the big companies may have more baggage, especially in the organic and natural space.
With the larger companies who invest in organic and natural brands, they have a credibility issue. They also have a legacy issue.
So small companies doing something new in that segment may appeal to retailers and to consumers like Nawatha Morris.
I like this flavor the best.
At a Mariano's grocery store in Chicago, Morris says she used to buy name brand teas because her kids liked them. Now she's buying Inco's, the brand Andy Horo works on.
They used to drink the Snapple, but I got them into drinking a sugar-free tea.
This makes Andy Horo giddy.
Come on!
This is my brand.
Given these little victories, I ask Horo to what extent small firms like his pose a threat to the bigger conglomerates. This question appears to strike him as absurd. He used to work on big brands at Pepsi and knows their advantages.
Being in a big brand, you have the power of the retailer listening to you all the time. You sell a lot of product. People want to work with you. You dial them on the phone, they're going to pick up the phone and take your call.
Whether it's getting the retailer's attention or keeping products well-stocked, Horo says for the little guys, it's all just a lot harder. In Chicago, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
No doubt you've heard a lot about fake news since the election and how to stop it from popping up, especially on social media. A group of tech researchers have been trying to use artificial intelligence to identify fake news. The effort even has a Twitter hashtag, Fake News Challenge. Cade Metz wrote about it for Wired. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
These researchers basically tried to build an AI that can spot fake news. Can you tell me what they did?
Well, they're in the process of trying. As this controversy over fake news has reached such heights, so many people are looking for ways of dealing with it. And one of the ways that has been floated is through what's called artificial intelligence. But the reality is that this is a very, very difficult problem to solve for many reasons, and this task is, in a sense, beyond what machines are capable of. So the technology they're building is a way of aiding this effort as opposed to really solving it.
Well, that brings us right up against the limits of what AI can do. Tell me about, because you focus on this moment where it's like, oh, they can sort of spot patterns, but they don't have judgment.
Exactly. The reason this is even a question is that AI has in recent years undergone a huge revival. It's now used, a technology called neural networks is now used to identify faces and objects in photos. And the hope is that it can be used to recognize fake news. The problem is that this solution is a bit more complex than that in the end.
When you spoke to the researchers and when you look at the landscape out there, do you think there's a role for an AI like this within, say, a Facebook or a Google or the companies that work as distribution mechanisms between people? Because that seems to be the place where a lot of this moves out into the larger world.
There's absolutely a role for it. But again, it's a complicated thing. Facebook in particular employs many, many contractors who are tasked with identifying material on the network that is not suitable and removing it. Sometimes algorithms and sometimes users of Facebook will flag what they see as potentially inappropriate material. And then these human contractors will make the final call. And this is what we're moving towards with the fake news problem. And perhaps we can build algorithms that can better identify fake news. But in the end, it's going to be humans that need to make that call.
Yeah, I guess did it surprise you at all that in investigating this, you know, kind of high-tech solution, you came back to something that is so intrinsically just a part of being human?
I don't think it's surprising. I've spent a lot of years, I have to say, you know, covering companies like Facebook. So I've seen the way it works, and I've seen the limitations of the technology. I think that what this shows is that the general public needs to understand that better. They need to understand the way that Facebook works, the way that Google works, a bit more than they do. And I think that that's part of the problem here, is that people are taking these things as you know, organs of automation and of truth, and they're not. They're flawed. They're flawed just like humans are flawed.
Cade Metz, senior staff writer at Wired, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this final note before we go today, one of the biggest guessing games in TV news has ended, and that was where Megyn Kelly would find herself once her Fox contract was up. She's making the jump to NBC, where she will host a daytime news show and one on Sunday evenings. It's unclear what Kelly will earn in her new job, but Fox reportedly offered her $20 million a year to stay. In a recent book, Kelly wrote both about the harassment allegations, including her own, against former Fox News head Roger Ailes, and that whatever network offered her the most money might not be the place she ended up. That is all for us. Today, the Dow rose 119 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ gained 45 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 advanced 19 points, 0.8%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you all tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.